Well, these are just some of my experiences of going for refuge, at least before the WBO was founded. Some of my experiences, not all, there are others, some of them of a more positive and inspiring nature. But you will have noticed at least one thing about the experiences which are the subject of my reminiscences tonight. You will have appreciated that real appreciation of the significance of the going for refuge is rather lacking nowadays. At least that should have been pretty obvious. Appreciation of the real significance of the going for refuge is certainly lacking in Buddhist circles in the East, and lacking even in some of the corresponding circles in the West. Both in the East and in the West, more often than not, the refuges are simply something that you recite, usually in Pali, at least in Southeast Asia. The refuges are something that show, or the recitation of the refuges is something that shows, in some way, that you are a Buddhist, that you belong to the Buddhist community in a social sense. One might even say that the refuges and the precepts in these circles, in these areas of the Buddhist world, are just a sort of flag that you wave on important occasions. You go to the temple on Wesak Day, you recite the refuges. If there's a wedding, somebody gets married, you recite the refuges. A baby is born, and when it's a few days old, it's given a name, you recite the refuges. Your grandfather dies, there's an after-death ceremony, you recite the refuges. There's a public meeting, say ratepayers association, you know, but they're all Buddhists, so they recite the refuges. And this reciting of the refuges shows that you're a decent, respectable, law-abiding person. This is the sort of significance it has nowadays, usually in the East. Now, there's nothing wrong with reciting. Reciting is a wonderful thing. We ourselves enjoy it very much. Let's recite the refuges, let's chant the refuges every day, every morning, every evening. Let's recite them 3 times a day. Let's recite them every hour. That would be fine if we could do that. Let's go on reciting them all day, chanting them all day. Far from there being anything wrong with that, that's highly desirable. I can think of a lot worse things for us to do in the course of the day. But the trouble is, nowadays, in the East, that though they recite, which is a good thing, people generally do nothing but recite the refuges. They don't think about the meaning. In my own personal experiences, only the Tibetan Buddhists, who have some appreciation, sometimes a very deep appreciation of what going for refuge really means, what it really implies in spiritual terms, deeply and fundamentally. It's only the Tibetans who've got some realization of the tremendous importance of the going for refuge, indeed of its central and basic importance in and for the Buddhist life. But elsewhere in the Buddhist world, whether it's Ceylon or Burma or Thailand or Japan, they just seem to have forgotten, almost entirely forgotten. People recite the refuges. Yes, they do recite them frequently and loudly. They recite the refuges, but they hardly ever really go for refuge. And this is really surprising when one thinks about it. Because the significance of the going for refuge, as distinct from merely reciting the words of the going for refuge formula, the significance of the going for refuge as the central act of the Buddhist life is clear enough from the scriptures, especially clear enough from the Pali scriptures. sort of reference to it. I was going to say almost on every page. It wouldn't be too much of an exaggeration perhaps to say even that. So let's look at the Pali scriptures. Let's look at some of these pages, many of these pages. And what do we find? There's a little group of people somewhere, maybe in the forest, maybe in the village. And the Buddha is giving a teaching. The Buddha is speaking. He may be giving this teaching to some non-Buddhist wanderer, maybe to a naked ascetic. He may be giving the teaching to a Brahmin priest, or to a king, or a householder of some kind, a merchant, or a sweeper, almost anybody, a housewife, a fisherman. I say the Buddha is giving a teaching, but perhaps I should say the Buddha just talks in the pages of the scriptures. He just talks. He just communicates with the people whom he happens to meet, who come his way. The Buddha is just himself. One might say he's just his own enlightened self in relation to whoever it is that he happens to meet. And he just talks. He may give quite a lengthy talk, quite a lengthy discourse, or he may say just a very few words. Usually he speaks in prose, of course, that being more normal, even in India. But occasionally, according to the Pali scriptures, he bursts into verse, even poetry, when he has something of special importance to impart, to communicate, something which he feels particularly deeply, as when he utters an udana, when he breathes forth some inspired utterance. And sometimes when he talks, when he communicates, whether in prose or verse, at length or in brief, he gives a profound philosophical exposition, and sometimes he just tells a story. What we usually call a parable, but really it's just a story with a meaning. But whatever he does, whatever he says, whatever and however he communicates, at length or in brief, in prose or in poetry, profoundly or simply, howsoever he does it, according to the scriptures, the effect is usually tremendous. Not to say shattering. Usually. Not always. Because human beings are free. Human beings are free not to be impressed, even by the Buddha, if they don't wish to be. They have that freedom. But usually, in the pages of the scriptures, they are impressed. Very deeply, very profoundly impressed by what the Buddha has to say. In fact, the Buddha's words, the Buddha's inspired speech, the Buddha's communication is just like a revelation to them. What he says opens up to them a completely new world. They see their own life in a completely new light. See, stretching before their feet, a new path, a path that stretches to infinity. And so hearing, so seeing, they feel their whole being, as it were, shaken to its foundations. This is the effect of the Buddha's utterance. The scriptures say that sometimes their hair stands on end with the shock. They even shed tears. They're so emotionally moved. When they try to speak, they find that their voice simply chokes. They can hardly speak for emotion. But when they do manage to speak, when they do manage to bring out a few words,
What do they say?
And in passage after passage, episode after episode, we get these same words. And we mustn't allow the fact of these words being repeated so many times to deaden or weaken their impact for us. So what do they say? What are the words that they manage to get out at last? With their hair standing on end and the tears in their eyes, they say, "It's amazing. Huh? It's amazing, Lord. It's wonderful." Huh? This is their reaction. This is the first thing that they say. Their reaction, or their response is this. It's a reaction of awe, huh? Of wonder, of astonishment, of amazement. Huh? This reminds me of Plato's statement that philosophy begins with wonder. So here too we see wonder and amazement, but in, we may say, a much more intense form. And then, having stammered out these words, having expressed their awe, wonder, astonishment and amazement, they try to describe what has happened. They try to describe their experience. And usually they give four comparisons. And you notice that at this point, this sort of psychological point, this crucial moment, when they're, as it were, on the brink of eternity, spiritually speaking, suspended in midair perhaps, and haven't yet come down and haven't yet started flying up, they have recourse to poetry. They speak in comparisons, not in terms of psychological or metaphysical analysis. The first thing they say is, "Lord, it's just as though something which had been overthrown, cast down, had been set upright. Just like a great pillar that had been lying in the dust. You take it and you haul it up and you set it upright, so that it's straight up, standing up. So they feel absolutely uplifted, stable, strong, secure, firm, erect, after having been downcast and overthrown." That's how they feel. And then they feel as though something which had been hidden had been revealed, made known. It was there all the time, but it was hidden. But now it's brought to light and they see it clearly. That's also how they feel. And then they feel as though the way had been pointed out to someone who had gone astray. They see their path clearly now. They know which way to go. There's no doubt, no hesitation, no confusion, no uncertainty. The way is clear. And then fourthly and lastly they say, "It's just as though a great light, a brilliant light, brighter even than the light of the sun, had shone forth in the midst of the darkness. And we can see now. We couldn't see before. We were in darkness before. We couldn't see before. But now we can see. This light has shone forth. We can all see." So, this is what they say. These are the comparisons they give. This is the poetry which they speak, expressing their feeling, expressing their experience, communicating their experience. So this is what people say when they feel the impact of the Buddha's word, the impact of the Dharma. And then, what is it that they do after feeling the impact of the Buddha's words, after hearing the Dharma? They say, "I go for refuge." Or as one should say, if one translates strictly, "For refuge I go. I go for refuge to the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha." This is what they say at that moment. And clearly, it's not just a question of the recitation of a formula. It's the heartfelt response of one's total being to the impact of the truth, even the impact of reality. One commits oneself to the truth. One surrenders to the truth. One wants to devote one's whole life to the truth. So, more often than not, those who've heard the Buddha's words, those who've felt the impact of the Dharma in this way, go forth. For them, going for refuge means going forth. They go forth from the group, go forth from the household life, go forth just as a single, solitary individual. And sooner or later, they're accepted into the spiritual community of others who have gone forth as single, solitary individuals. They're accepted into the spiritual community of what I've called sometimes the full-timers.